numbers don't run out for sure. Because whatever number you got, you can always add one. So it seems like the numbers don't depend upon the world. The numbers are there. Even if the world runs out, the numbers don't run out. Well, now, leaving aside religion for a minute, even if you take gracious, there was a time when there were no people. Were there no numbers when there were no people? Did numbers start existing when people started existing? Doesn't sound right. I mean, you know, there were blades of grass, and there probably was a number of them, and there were even squirrels, I guess. And there was a number of them, and, you know. So, doesn't seem like numbers. If everybody goes to sleep at the same time, do the numbers disappear in the meantime? And then when we wake up and we're thinking about them, they come back? Somehow, doesn't sound right. The numbers seem to be divorced in their own being, in their own nature. They seem to be divorced from the physical world altogether. Of course, they connect. There are two cups of water on this table, and three tape recorders on this table, and one Avis Express card on this table, belonging to someone named Noah Fletcher. We probably should pick it up. So, numbers somehow relate to this world, but numbers aren't. They relate to the physical world. They relate to the physical world, but they aren't part of the physical world. Same thing with geometrical shapes. You got square and triangle and hexagon, octagon. You could worry. A geometrical square is exactly the same length of sides. Now, when you are in eighth grade shop, wood shop, and you plane down your piece of wood to a square, is it exactly the same length on all four sides? Probably not. Is it really a square? Really? So what is really a square? It's in Plato's heaven, you know, some kind of ideal square somewhere. But in our world, we have, you know, little crooked things and little bent things and things on the sides, you know, extend a little bit over the edge. But even worse than that, what about a Schillinger gun, which is a figure that has 1,000 equal sides? There's nothing in our world that's even close. Not even close. Bees' cells are hexagons because only squares and hexagons, I think, can be nested together without any lost space. Schillinger? So then, what is it, this Schillinger? And we have geometrical theorems about it. We can calculate its area, how it relates to a circle, and so forth and so on. What's that it? It's not something in our physical world, and yet we have a whole study of those things. We seem to know a lot about those things. Another example. I'm going beyond numbers, but it's a whole family of problems. Imagine, this is based on an argument by David Hume. Imagine that you have a color chart. It starts from the reds and it goes to the blues. And it's very gradual. It's very gradual. It's almost, when you look at it, it's hard to see. If you take a small slice, it's hard to see the change. But over the whole thing, it changes from red to blue. Now, let's imagine that this color chart has on it the colors of everything in the world. And you're looking at this color chart, you're going along, sliding along, and the colors are gradually blending from red into blue, and you get into the light blue area, and then as you're looking at it, there seems to be a little jump. There's an area where it isn't as smooth as the rest of it. It looks like they left out a little bit. Not that there's white space on the paper. No, the paper's all color. But as you move, you come to this little section, it seems that the color is changing faster than the rest of the time. So if you take a very narrow slice, it seems like it's jumping from, you know, from color to color. It's not filling in all the missing colors. All the in-between colors. I should say missing. She's not filling in all the in-between colors. Now, I suppose you look at it very carefully with a magnifying glass, and you come to a point and you say, yeah, look at that. Up to here is one thing. From here on it starts another thing, and the in-between is missing. They left it out. Over here it jumps. Could that happen? Am I contradicting myself somewhere? Am I making a mistake in this description? Seems like it very well could happen, right? Well, now, you picture in your mind's eye. See, what's happened over here is, smack dab, next to one another, there are two colors, but they left out the one in between. So that's why this one to this one's a jump. You could probably sort of picture in your mind's eye the one that's missing. You know, it looks like that. In between, a little darker than this one, a little lighter than that one. That's the one that belongs right there. Now this color that you're talking about, this color you can imagine in your mind, is nowhere in our world. Because the chart that you have there has on it the colors of every physical thing. Blue shells of robin's eggs, and blue sea urchins, and lavender fruit flies. I don't know, you know, the whole sky when it turns dark at night. There's nothing that has that color. But we have no difficulty in conceiving of that color. So what are we conceiving of? What is this thing we're conceiving of? It's not part of our physical world at all. Yet, it seems, we can come to understand it without difficulty. Now here's the puzzle. If numbers aren't physical things, and geometrical shapes aren't physical things, and properties, the qualities that objects have aren't physical things, how do we know anything about them? How do we know anything about them? Because knowledge of things we usually get by experiencing them. I know about the table because I see it and I touch it. Okay, if you went to France to taste the wine, you could tell me about what you saw and what you touched and what you tasted, and I could know about it. But knowledge usually requires coming in contact with things. That's certainly how you get knowledge of physical objects. Somebody has contact. Okay, it could be contact through a telescope which looks back in time. That's not science fiction. Real telescopes look back in time. It takes a long time for the light to get here. So from that light, you're seeing what happened a long time ago. Or microscopes tell us that the table is made of molecules. So when I touch the table, I'm touching molecules. I'm touching them. Or when you use a microscope, so you're interacting with them, physically interacting with them. So, for a whole range of things, what it means to have knowledge of them is to interact with them. To have an impact on you. See them, touch them. You analyze the things that you touch and find out they're made of them. Here, we're talking about knowledge of something that can't be touched, can't be seen, can't be tasted, has no aroma. Can't grind it, can't paint it, can't break it in half, you can't dissolve it with acid, can't shoot holes in it, you just can't interact with it. So the question is, how do we know anything about it? What explanation could we have for how we know something about it? Now, it's very important. I'm going to push the question to a further stage to avoid an objection. It's worse than just asking, how can we have knowledge of it? Let's pretend that we are just physical bodies, you and I. I mean, everybody here with the hat on knows that's wrong. But all right, let's just pretend for a minute. That's the game of philosophy. Pretend you're just a physical body and see how far you can get. Well, if all I am is a physical body, and all I do is I interact with other physical bodies, then it begins to look impossible that I should have knowledge of these things that aren't physical bodies and can't have any effect on physical bodies. They can't. Now, how in heaven's name do I know anything about them? Now, if we admit that the human being is more than a body, human being also has a soul. A soul is not a physical thing. Then we have the possibility of interacting with those non-physical things. It seems like, it is important, I'll explain in a moment why it's important, but the exact statement of the question is, if you think you are only a physical body, it seems hopeless to explain how we can have knowledge of things that aren't physical. Because we can't interact with them in any way. But if you are a physical body and a non-physical soul, then the non-physical soul, at least, is on the right side of the dividing line to interact with the non-physical things called numbers and properties. Well, some things of philosophers are biting this bullet. Numbers and properties and geometrical figures. I'll take 2 minutes to finish, then I'll take questions. Why did I say it was important to put it this way? Because some people complain that even after you elect to have a soul, still you can't explain how you know anything about numbers. What is the soul? How does it work? What are its laws? What are its pieces? What are its rules? What exactly are numbers on the non-physical side? And how do they interact? How does one give you knowledge of the other? You can't answer any of those questions. Correct. I can't answer any of those questions. So how are you any better off after you bring in the soul? You didn't understand how the body does it, and you don't understand how the soul does it. What progress do you make by assuming you have a soul? The answer is this. If I'm a body, and only a body, it seems to me clearly impossible to have knowledge. I have a positive barrier. The barrier is I'm not the right kind of thing to interact with a number, or with a property, or with a geometrical shape. So if I stick with body, and I recognize that those other things aren't physical, I have a barrier that seems impossible to cross. If I have a soul, there is no barrier. Now that doesn't mean I've explained in detail how it works, but now at least the possibility of explaining has opened up. Now we can start to work and wonder, and even if we never get an explanation, at least we could say we have two elements that belong to the same universe, and therefore there could possibly be a relationship between them, even though we can't explain what the relationship is. But if you're talking about a body in those objects, it seems that it's impossible for them to have. So there's a step forward. It doesn't solve all the problems. Maybe you think of it as a small step. But it does seem to be a necessary step so that you open up the possibility of progress. Whereas if you're only a body, doesn't seem to be any possibility of progress. Now, one of the greatest logicians and mathematicians of the 20th century, a fellow named Kurt Gödel, who revolutionized logic and single-handedly put the end to a whole school of mathematics with one singular theorem. I wrote my PhD thesis on that theorem. It's the fundamental theorem of all 20th century logic. He said, any mathematician will tell you that he sees numbers, and he sees functions, and he sees spaces, and he sees manifolds, and he sees groups. He pictures them, and he manipulates them, and he discovers their qualities. When he proves a proof, what he's doing is confirming his discovery of their qualities. And the demonstration of it is that when he publishes his proof, all the other mathematicians agree. And you have proofs from ancient Greece, 2,300 years ago, and they're still standing. So these things, the numbers, the functions, the spaces, the rest of them, behave like external realities,
external realities that these people are perceiving? Their characteristics compel them to assent? You don't have people saying, well, you know, in my world, I see 7 plus 5 is 11. That's the way I see it. And I say, 13, you know. In my world, girl of 7 is true. And the other guy says, no, in my world, it isn't true. You know, it isn't like that. So girl said, obviously, we must have some element in us that perceives numbers, analogously to the way eyes perceive tables. But since the number is in the table, it can't be your eyes. There's something else in us that functions as eyes to see numbers with. Because the whole experience of doing mathematics is like the experience of a scientist who's discovering the properties of things outside of him by virtue of examining them in his mind. Now, there are people who are allergic to this way of talking just because they have very sensitive allergies. But they don't have any answer to the question. The question is a very old question, and to date, philosophy of mathematics has no, I would say, certainly doesn't have any agreed upon answer, but they don't even have any plausible answers. It's just a very deep and difficult problem. If you don't postulate a soul, it seems like you have a clear impossibility of explaining how you have knowledge of these things. If you postulate a soul, at least you've taken away that impossibility, though all the positive work of explaining how it works in detail has yet to be done.
Now, I know that this question could kind of be answered by the Cartesian standard, but the whole problem with that. But like, why do we have to come to the conclusion that there's a soul? Why can't we just say yes, there's mind and body, and then the mind is something else? But you don't have to just go along and say that there's a soul with all the other properties that it may entail. You could just
okay, no, I agree with you. I didn't mean so. You're right.
To be another extra.
You're right. I'll take it back. 100%. I just mean that you can't be just body. There has to be a non-physical component to you that does this work. Beyond that, I'm just arguing for that. That's all. I'm arguing here for the materials. That's all. You're quite right. Yeah.
The same way you have body to comprehend numbers, why can't you have the same possibility of body to this non-physical thing?
I did.
Well, how could you say the body has a non-physical feature, a soul?
Let's start over again. What did you say?
It's impossible for a physical body to comprehend these non-physical numbers.
Correct.
Why is it not possible for a physical body to have a spiritual soul?
Because you switched from comprehend to have. You started with comprehend and you switched to have. Why should I go from one to the other?
Why can't the
did anybody say that the body comprehends the soul? Absolutely not. The body doesn't comprehend the soul either.
The body could use the soul to comprehend.
The soul itself? Sure, of course it could. That's only if you have a soul. Which is the conclusion I was trying to sort of drive from. Yeah.
Similar to what you were saying, but does imagination have to mean the body? Or imagination is without the physicality?
Well, the question will be how the imagination works. If imagination is simply conjuring up memory images of things you've experienced, that's fine. Maybe you could imagine the imagination can sort of rearrange them and take the arm of an octopus and attach it to an eagle and sort of make phantasmagoric monsters and so forth and so on. But how is the imagination going to leap to an entirely different dimension of things that can't be experienced?
Just with the color.
Yeah, I mean, you got colors that you do experience. Fine. So I can imagine, the imagination thinking, I saw that turquoise shell, so I can remember the turquoise shell. So I can dream about turquoise. And I can imagine painting my house turquoise to look like the shell. And that would be lovely to do that. So I can paint the house turquoise. But to imagine a color that you've never seen?
Can you just imagine a job lighter?
Well, but how do you do that? How do you do more than what you've actually seen? That's the question. Yeah.
Is the same question that the Anglos just confirmed? Remembering physical representation.
Anger?
Oh,
engram.
E-N-G-R-A-M, like the physical representation.
The engram. Sorry, that's how they pronounce it? Anger?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was pronouncing it engram. No, there the problem is, what is it about the brain that codes memory? The engram is supposed to be the feature of the brain that codes memory. And they're all in search of the engram.
right? And every year they announce they found it, the next year they found, oh no, gosh, we thought that was it, but it turned out to be the, it's a very, very complicated issue, what it is in the brain that codes memory. But that's not going to help us, because that's memory of things you've experienced. That's not going to get us beyond experience. Here we're talking about knowing something about things that are inherently beyond all experience. So the question is, if it's inherently beyond all experience, and knowledge comes from experience, so it's very hard to understand where the knowledge of these things comes from. Unless it's experience of another kind. Experience in another part of yourself. Yes, that, then you could do it. If you're another part of yourself that can experience numbers, then you could be home free. But then you got to admit that you have to, there's another part of yourself that does that experiencing.
So it's more like the question is, where do the concepts come from? Why is there a potential for concepts?
Yeah, for concepts of things that are beyond experience. Right. Usually we think of forming concepts as a response to experience. Right? You interact with things and you come to learn the aspects that are important to pay attention to, and that's how you form your concepts. Here you're talking about forming a concept of things that's not part of experience at all.
It is, in a way, part of experience, because what we do is bring the concept down to reality and say that, okay, like, for example, the number six. Okay, I'm going to apply this on a physical level, you know, and just count six books or something. So what is, like, the connection between bringing it down? What was that, you know? Like?
Yeah, okay, let's work on this now. This is the second half, and I think that what you're saying now leads to the second half. If we'll clear that up, I think the problem will be even more obvious. Let's take simple arithmetic. 7 plus 5 is 12. That was Kant's example. Now, what do we mean when we say 7 plus 5 is 12? And how do we know it's true? What are we talking about? We say 7 plus 5 is 12. Here's an example. Is this what we mean? I have a big bag. There are apples on the table. I count out 7 into the bag. I stop. Then I count out 5 more into the bag. Then, when I pour them out of the table and we count them, there'll be 12. The 7 plus 5 is 12 mean that when I put things together in a physical way, the countings will come out in a certain way. Is 7 plus 5 equals 12 a statement about how things happen in our world? Is that what it's about? Is that what it says? Do we learn it from experience? You count out 7, you count out 5, you count all up. By golly gosh, there they are. 12 every time. So you just get used to it. In fact, it happens so regular, so universally, that you come to really rely on it. You think, boy, if anything's stable, that's really stable. Then I count out 7, count out 5, count all up. It's always 12. Is that the kind of idea that it is? It's a kind of law of nature. But it's a law of nature that happens so often, so regularly, so perfectly, that, you know, it's even better than gravity, I guess. I mean, it's just like no exceptions. This is the John Stuart Mill thought. It's just a very, very common, everyday, universal law of nature. But this is wrong. Watch. I've come into your kitchen. And there are tables on your table. And there are apples on your table. And I said, listen, I want to show you something. I want to show you something about my bag. I count out 7 of your apples into the bag. And then I count out 5 more of your apples into the bag. I clear a space on the table. Pour out all the apples. And I count them up. 8, 9, 10, 11. So you say, wait a minute, 11? What happened to the other apple? In my bag, 7 plus 5 is 11. You got back all your apples. Because in my bag, 7 plus 5 is 11. Other places it's 12, but not in my bag. In my bag, 7 plus 5 is 11. So you got back all your apples. Your apples used to be 12, but your apples are now 11 because they were 12 on the table, but now they're 11. It's the same apples and the same number of apples. Because in my bag, 7 plus 5 is 11. Somehow I don't think you're going to buy it. You're not going to look for a hole in the bag. Or you're going to say, I must have palmed one, you know, and I was putting it in the bag, shoved it up my sleeve or something, you know. Tossed it in the back to a rat who ate it up very quickly. I mean, it's... But why? If this is just a statement about how things happen, we should be open in principle to discover that, contrary to what we thought, it doesn't always happen that way. Suppose I told you that in my backyard, I have a little patch of ground with anti-gravity. Over there, things float. Yeah, very funny, ha ha ha. Now you come to the back of my house, and you know, you step on it, and up you go. Right. And you put things there, and they hang in the air. So you swipe the swords underneath, and nothing cuts, you know, no ropes above, and so on. You invite in scientists. There, I think you could imagine discovering that gravity doesn't always hold. Because gravity really is just a law of nature. All I have for gravity is that I see it work all the time. If all I have is that I see it work all the time, it's possible to imagine finding a place where it doesn't work all the time. Indeed, the latest cosmological theories say that the force of gravity at great distances is repulsive, not attractive. Nobody says, oh, that's unthinkable, it must be a mistake. You know, we discovered that gravity doesn't always behave the same way. That's not inconceivable, because all you have for gravity is, I watched it and saw that's what it did. So, it's open to look at it someplace else and find out it does something else. That's the way we are about laws of nature. Even laws of nature that are operating all the time, still, if they're just based on observing something that happens all the time, it's possible to discover a new observation where it isn't working that way all the time. With numbers, you won't tolerate that. There's nothing you could experience that would lead you to say, oh gosh, 7 plus 5 isn't always 12. Sometimes it's 11. So it seems that 7 plus 5 is 12 is not a statement about how things always happen. We're not going to tolerate 7 plus 5 ever being 11. If you add 7 and 5 of them and get and physically you find 11, one's missing. And you better pay for it. No one's going to accept the explanation that on that occasion 7 plus 5 was 11. So it seems that when we know mathematics, we know something that's above our world. It's superior to our world. No matter what goes on in our world, this is going to be right. But then, you know, then it sounds like it's totally disconnected. It's totally disconnected. There are these concepts hanging in the sky, and we play with them, or we look at them, and they sort of move together this way and that way. No matter what's going on down here, in the thick world in which we live, that stuff always stays the same. No, if that stuff always stays the same, it's like it's sort of irrelevant. It's irrelevant. You know what it's like? It's like chess. If the Democrats win, the rules of chess stay the same. If the Republicans win, the rules of chess stay the same. If there's a revolution and we become an anarchical society with no government, the rules of chess stay the same. They're just disconnected from what happened. Actually, the truth is, if the Democrats win, they'll change the rules, because that's what they do. But, all right, that's just politics. Let's not talk about that. Chess is just a game. It's a game. It's made up, and it's completely cut off from the rest of the real world. It has its own rules, and it functions in its own way. So, in a certain sense, math feels like that. A squared plus B squared equals C squared in a right angle triangle. That's just the way those triangles are. No? Plain right angle triangle. No frills. P-L-A-N-E. Now, the puzzle then is, if this is really something that's abstract, up in the sky, it stays the same no matter how the world is. It's totally disconnected from the world, like chess. How come we can use it? How come we can use it in describing the world? How come all of science is based on mathematics? How does the mathematics come in if no matter what happens, the mathematics will stay the same? Nobody has an answer to this question. Nobody has an answer to this question. It's one of the fundamental questions in philosophy and mathematics. That was my field. Nobody has an answer to this question. How can it be that the thing you know is so abstract, so high, so disconnected, that it's the same no matter what happens, and yet you can use it in describing the actual world in which we live?
more than that. People think up systems of mathematics. There are people called pure mathematicians. That's what they do. You know, in their offices, what you have is a table, a chair, and a coffee urn. That's it. They sit there and they think. Well, that's what it used to be. Now I guess they play with computers. But you know, they just sit there and think. And they think up these structures. They think up how they work. And then they prove theorems and they make a living. Now, why isn't it just play? Why is it that the really complicated structures they think of, very complicated, very abstract, many of them turn out to be very useful for describing the real world? Why should that be? There's a fellow named Eugene Wigner, who had a Nobel Prize in physics, who wrote a paper, I guess, about 30 years ago, called The Unreasonable Applicability of Mathematics in Science. He reflected on the fact that mathematicians have created these abstract structures, and when physicists need mathematics to describe what's going on, they pick up the books of the mathematicians, and lo and behold, there they are. Even Einstein did that. He was working on curved space-time, and he was struggling to figure out what mathematics would do the job, and somebody said, why don't you read Riemann, who had done it 50 years before, just abstractly. And there it was, just imported Riemann manifolds in order to describe curved space time. It was right there on, you know, right there in the book. What is there about the human mind that cooks up these completely abstract schemes, which later turn out to be useful to describe stars and describe space and describe gravity and describe the Big Bang? Why isn't everything the mind creates, like chess, useless? Except for whittling away your time till you die. Playing a game. That's what you'd expect. It's just a game. The guy just made it up because he was interested in it. So it can all be chess or Go or checkers or, you know. Somehow, people thinking in a certain mood, working together with a certain common conception of what's interesting and what's important, what's significant, cook up these abstract schemes and bang, they're right there and they use them to describe reality. It's very, very strange. Another problem in the same basket, and then I'll stop taking questions again. Scientists are in the business of cooking up theories, many of them. Cooking up theories. You got all sorts of stuff that you've experienced, all sorts of experiments, rattle them off. What makes it work that way? So they think up a theory that will fit everything that they see. Now, the truth is, there's a great variety of theories. If you have a good imagination, you can cook up lots and lots and lots of theories. Let me give you an example of how this works. A simple example. Let's suppose you have a graph. You're doing experiments. The result of each experiment is a point on the graph. Here's a very simple example. How fast does a cube of sugar dissolve in a glass of water? Depends upon how hot the water is. The hotter the water is, the faster the sugar will disappear. Right? So you're doing this experiment. So at 10 degrees centigrade, this is the heat, and this is how fast it dissolves. So at 10 degrees centigrade, it dissolves this fast. 20 degrees off this fast. 30 degrees off this fast. 40 degrees off that fast. 50 degrees off this that fast. Okay. So you've done 8 experiments, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, and 90. And you put a dot on the thing for everyone, right? Now I ask you, what law does this represent? I've only got 8 dots. I'd like to know the whole law that connects heat and how fast it dissolves. So you say, that's easy. Listen, we'll play a game that every 3-year-old knows. It's called Connect the Dots, right? They all know how to do that. You can even get a 3-year-old to do it for you. Just connect the dots. And then you've got the law that connects heat and how fast it dissolves. Right. Connect the dots. But reflect, gentlemen, we're not 3-year-olds. Reflect that there's a lot of different ways to connect the dots. Who says you play, do it with a smooth line? Let's do it with a wavy line, like this. which is called the sine curve. Or you could start by going down, because you're pessimistic, and use a cosine curve, right? And go like that through the points, right? Or jagged lines up and down through the points. Who told you what kind of line to draw? How many different lines do you think there are that could go through all through the points, right? I'll bet there's no end to them, right? Because they could be big hubs! Bigger and bigger hubs to infinity. Right? Who told you which line to choose? All of them are going to make different predictions. If you try an experiment on a point you haven't checked yet, a point you haven't examined yet, every one of those lines is going to make a different prediction. How do you know which line to trust? Now, scientists have an answer to this question, or at least they have a word. They pick the... What's the word? Simplest. They pick the simplest line, the simplest hypothesis, the simplest law, the simplest theory. Yes, they do. They pick the simplest one. Quite right. The only trouble is, no one has a clue as to how to define simplicity. What really makes it simple? And, from a philosophical point of view, even worse, no one has a clue how to explain why the simpler one is better. And the worst people at this are the scientists. Because when you ask them why they pick the simpler one, they say silly things like, well, it's more beautiful. Okay. Okay, maybe it is more beautiful, but why would you trust beauty as a sign of truth? What would the connection possibly be? Just because it tickles your aesthetics? Therefore, it's more likely to be true? Suppose somebody's life depends upon this. Suppose avoiding the missile depends upon this. So, oh, well, that curve has such a graceful lift. You know, I'm sure you'll find the missile there. Why? What has looking inside to my aesthetics got to do with predicting where the missile is when it's, you know, into Chicago? Somehow, but it works. It works. When scientists pick what they believe to be the simplest curve, they're very often correct. More often than they would be correct if they were just guessing. The question is, why does it work? What is there about what's going on in the mind with this property of simplicity, which no one can define, we just sort of know in our guts, this is more simple than that. Yeah, that's the right one. Sure, everybody can see that. Why? I don't know, just follow your guts, right? That's what true science is about, following your guts, right? And it works. So what it seems like is, and the name for the general proposition here is, that we have a whole bunch of things which we somehow know something about. We can't explain how we know anything about them. And what we know about them seems to be somehow disconnected. And yet, it applies in the world. A friend of mine named Mark Steiner, who's a professor at the university here, Herzlfin, wrote a book published by Harvard, where he extended Wigner's idea. There are times in physics where physicists cook up a theory to explain something, and their theory is expressed in certain symbols. And then they say, you know how we'll make the next move? Let's make the symbol simpler. And they're just looking at the pattern and symbols on the paper. That's all they got. And they say, listen, if we manipulate it in symbols like this, the symbols will come out simpler. So that's the best theory. And Steiner says, my gosh, you know, how do you get from the marks on paper to what's better in the world? And he claims that there isn't a clue. This is more abstract. It's not the concepts of the theory are simpler, but it's the notation that we have chosen to use to express the concepts in is simpler. It's doubly removed from the world. The concepts are already removed from the world. The notation is just the marks we make up to write it down with. And yet some moves to solve problems in physical theory are based on how to simplify the notation. Now, intuitively, that shouldn't have any connection with the real world at all. So, the picture I think we seem to get is that there's a world of the abstract things, that part of us somehow knows what's going on in those abstract things, and that even though they're abstract, and even though they seem to be totally disconnected from reality, they're very useful for describing reality, as if to say,
The world of the abstract and the world of the concrete are somehow created, coordinated to one another. And that the part of me that knows the abstract is getting an insight into what's really going on in the physical world, even though we can't explain what relationship the abstract has with the physical world. Now, as I said at the outset, if you have a soul, you at least have the right elements to begin to attack the problem. But if you are just a body, it is very, very difficult to see how you have the right elements to attack the body. So, let me summarize what we've done in the last 3 weeks. I don't know what we're going to do next week, but we started off 2 weeks ago with a problem of experience. Felt experience, and we argued that there's good reason to think that can't be the brain. It's got to be something else that's not physical where the felt experiences take place. Last week we talked about quantum mechanics. When you're not looking, the world is foam, fuzz, rippling along on the square roots of probability. Everything foaming at once. You take a look, bang, everything collapses into a point. Nobody knows how that happens. Some say that the only thing that can do it is non-physical experience. Because if you're physical, you're also fuzz. Everything becomes fuzz that's physical, according to the official theory. So if everything becomes fuzz, nothing can collapse into a point. But we see points. So where do the points come from? They come from the fact that we experience it. Who's the we experiencing it? If it's just the brain, it's more fuzz. So it's got to be something which is experiencing it, experiencing the measurement, and that's what collapses the fuzz. So this non-physical thing first is the realm of experience in general, feeling, thought. Then it's the realm in which the experience takes place that affects the world directly, collapses the quantum waves into a concrete reality. And now it's the realm in which we have knowledge of abstract things like numbers and properties and geometrical shapes and simplicity of concepts and notation. And somehow those abstract things are very useful for describing the world in which we live. Well, I think if we put all those things together, we're getting at least a picture of a thing, an entity, a thing, which has feeling, has thought, can picture the world, interact with it in ways that changes the world, like in quantum measurement, which can imagine and understand and know abstract things and use that knowledge of abstract things to describe the world in which we live. So, in terms of feeling, felt experience, and intellect, and having an impact on the world through this abstract thing, this non-physical thing, that much I think we have evidence for from philosophy, from mathematics, from science. We have evidence for the existence of such a thing. And these are some of the qualities that we traditionally associate with the soul.
Couldn't the whole fuzz thing just be an illusion that our eyes aren't necessarily equipped to understand?
No, it can't be, because the fuzz has real physical effects. It has real physical effects. It affects where particles are found when they're tested for. If it were just a matter of our vision, then the objects wouldn't behave as if they were fuzz. They would behave as if they were normal particles, just that we wouldn't see how they behave. And if we look and see them, then they don't behave that way anymore. They only behave that way when we're not looking. The fuzz only works when we're not looking.
It's also when we monitor it.
What's that?
It's also when we monitor it.
If you monitor it, it doesn't work. You have to wait till the end and just look at the results. If you monitor it in the middle, you spoil it.
Why? That means that the monitor doesn't have a soul.
Well, monitor. I mean, monitor means that we look at the monitor, right?
Yeah, but the monitor was seeing what was, not what is now.
Yeah, but it didn't see it until we look at it. Indeed, they have ways of doing it like this. You get a very long experiment, spread out in space and spread out in time. And if you don't look to the end, you can affect how it was before. Because it didn't finish until you look before you looked.
Did they do that?
Yeah, they've done that. That's really good. It looks like you're having an effect on the past. There's a wonderful book called About Time by Paul Davies, about which he has a whole chapter on this. It's a wonderful book altogether, but there's a whole chapter on this delayed effect experiments. All right, so the moral that I draw is the moral that I started out with 3 weeks ago, and that is that we shouldn't be afraid of the concept of the soul, that it isn't as anti-scientific and anti-philosophical as some people would have you think. There are scattered references in various disciplines which would really lead to support for the existence of something like the soul. All right?
Last place for the